to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life. The purpose of the show is to introduce you to people who are involved in some way in pushing forward the agenda of our health services towards greater freedom of choice for people with cancer and a broader, more inclusive approach to treatment, an approach that's generally called integrative medicine or integrative oncology when particularly applied to cancer. My guest today is someone who has worked closely with supporting people with cancer for over 25 years. She's had cancer herself, and this has spurred her to specialise in this field. Naturopath Dr. Naysha Winters is the author, along with Jess Kelly, of a new book on cancer, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, which is due out very soon in the UK. I'm speaking to Naysha over Skype in Durango, Colorado. Naysha, fantastic to have you on the show. I've been watching what you're up to out there, and you're obviously a great activist in the field of integrative medicine, and so it's a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, I am incredibly grateful to be here, Robin, and again, I love the work you're doing and promoting in the world, and I look forward to our chat today.
Great. Well, today we're going to be talking about probably some of the most contentious issues in cancer theory, cancer prevention, and cancer treatment that are around.
We're hitting them all.
Yeah, an example is that myth number 4 in Cancer Research UK's 10 persistent cancer myths debunked is that eating sugar feeds cancer. Others include that superfoods can be used in cancer prevention, or actually even that they exist at all, or that you can affect the body's pH through diet, or that there's even any point in trying. So your new book, written with Jess Higgins Kelly, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, flies in the face of establishment thinking about cancer, and it advises a completely different way of viewing it and of treating it. So if you're right, how could so many of our leading cancer organisations have got it so wrong?
Well, that's a nice start. We're just going to dive right in.
Yeah.
First of all, you know, I love it because I have been on this journey for myself, as well as helped facilitate this journey for, you know, well over 10,000 people over the last quarter century. So I, of course, learned, as have many of my conventionally trained colleagues, of the somatic DNA damage theory of cancer, which has been, I would call it, a good 75-year experiment. That, of course, it sounds great, right? It sounds like this should make all the sense. When we dove into identifying the genome and mapping it out, we really thought we'd have all of the answers to the universe. And unfortunately, it came up really short of that. And so it's very interesting, sort of like that definition of insanity when, you know, you keep using a hammer on a screw and you keep thinking you're going to get a different outcome. Well, we've been practicing a little bit of insanity for a while now, and it's time to kind of look outside of that. And in the past quarter century for myself, I've had that opportunity, possibly because I am a practitioner who thinks outside of the box and was trained outside of the box, but also I had to heal myself. I had to work on my own chemistry so I could survive. And I tell you, nothing pushes you to learn than your life depending on it.
Right.
So in doing this for myself, right? So I had to learn a lot along the way. And I've had incredible aha moments and successes that started to show me that maybe we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater on the idea of the somatic, you know, DNA damage theory, but we are coming at it the wrong way. If our mitochondria are healthy, happy, in good working order, and sufficient enough in numbers, then we are much less prone to DNA damage or the expression of our epigenetics, you know, that we were passed, you know, down from prior generations. So if we start to tune up the mitochondria, we start to change the diagnoses and even the treatment, and also prevention, and even prevention of recurrence. And that's what I started seeing about 25 years ago in myself. And I devoted my life to looking at it more from the other doorway in, you know, heal the mitochondria to heal the DNA versus heal the DNA to heal the mitochondria.
Hmm. Okay. Well, look, we're going to go into all of that in a bit more detail as we go on, I hope. So maybe you'd like to start out by telling us who your book's aimed at. Is it just for practitioners or experts?
I love that question. I get asked this a lot by colleagues who've read the book, you know, and when we were starting the process, as well as patients who've worked with me for a long period of time. We wanted to reach both. We wanted everyone to have a chair at the table. We wanted everyone to have the same conversation and to have the same understanding. So we may be pushing the patient a little bit, although the feedback I've gotten from the patient person, this is a very easy and engaging read. And I've also had comments from my colleagues, scientists and practitioners and researchers saying, wow, I it's a good way to think about it differently. Learned something, or I'd forgotten those basics of my biochemistry or my physiology. And so I feel like it's really an opportunity for us to all sit at the table together and have a great dialogue.
Well, that's great. So the person in the street could get through this quite comfortably and would gain a lot from it then.
Exactly. Great. And Robin, I'd love to go back to add to the why the disparity in the knowledge of a metabolic approach to cancer. Another reason it just my brain clicked in on this is that right now down the hallway, you know, at Johns Hopkins University, a very esteemed, you know, academic university and hospital in this country, literally in the same establishment, we have two diabolically opposed, you know, at least in their minds, conversations happening between the Vogelstein camp, which is sort of the father of the genome concept of really pushing, you know, cancer as a DNA disorder. He's in the last 2 years had two studies, I should say, that have come out really saying that cancer is just, you know, your bad luck. And really what's unfortunate is that's not exactly what Dr. Vogelstein was trying to say. He's actually talking about certain proliferative potentials, certain stem cell tissue lines. This is not applicable to the human, to the whole person. And yet the headlines run with it, right? Like he's talking about some stem cell lines in cell line studies versus the reality that happens in humans. And so I think that the media has also run and taken his research out of context to a bit. And he comes from the lineage of DNA. So that's his baby. You know, it's kind of like he's going to keep holding on to and supporting that because it's been his life's work and his life's passion. And so just down the hall on the other side is Dr. Peterson with a D, who is part of the Tripping Over the Truth fame and that book that Travis Christofferson wrote about the emerging science and understanding of cancer as a metabolic theory. These guys are under the same roof, and they are both having very different conversations. And my feeling is that probably somewhere between each of their labs and each of their offices lies the truth, or elements of the truth, or things that we're learning and understanding. And so I wish that we could get away from this us and them. I think it's very much a we and an ongoing building on the conversation. And that I'm excited. I think the metabolic theory actually gives more credence to the genomic DNA concept because, my gosh, if we can affect the genes by affecting our mitochondria first, everybody wins in this conversation.
Very interesting. So John Hopkins is a little bit schizophrenic at the moment then. Well, interesting, isn't it? It's very like the situation. I mean, here we are this year, particularly in the UK, we're trying to promote dialogue between orthodox medicine and all of those outside orthodox medicine, which doesn't really happen in this country at all. And it's a similar kind of situation because, of course, there's so much to be gained from both sides, and yet they won't talk to each other. And
exactly.
The adversarial model for progress is an extremely poor one in my mind, and we need to collaborate.
Agreed.
Okay, so there is an amazing amount we could talk about today. Any one of your chapters in your book could fill an entire show without any problem. So we're going to have to limit ourselves a little bit to the overview. But your book, in common with some others, focuses very much on what is referred to as the terrain. Can you explain exactly what you mean by this and why it's so important?
Oh, perfect. Well, I am very visual, so I'll give you my visual description to maybe help your listeners see it how I see it. So I think of us as just a living, breathing, dynamic life cycle organism, right? And so none of us function in a vacuum. And so we are bouncing off of other people all the time. We're bouncing off of what we're exposed to from our media, from what we're exposed to in the environment, in our food, et cetera. So we have to take all of those variables into account. So when I start to talk to a patient or a colleague about how I am analyzing or addressing or supporting the terrain, I explain to them the idea of a tree. And so you have this beautiful big canopy of this big, bushy, healthy, vital tree, which is that canopy I liken to the epigenetics. You know, the above the genes, the way that we might have come in with this blueprint, but we're the contractors. We can rearrange the furniture depending on how we decide to decorate it, if you will. In that big canopy where I'm calling it also the epigenetics, within that framework is also the mitochondria. And those are our energy powerhouses. That is what gets us up and moving. That is the gasoline in our cars, in our proverbial body cars. And that tree itself is growing up and out of the soil, which I liken to the microbiome. And so the health and function and the diversity of that soil is very much driving the health or disease process of that tree. And then the trunk that grows out of that soil is the mind body, the emotional center of our body. We can't, you know, we're human beings having very emotional experiences, and it's hard to separate those out from the physical experiences. And so from that trunk connecting the soil to the canopy, we have these seven branches. And these seven branches might include things like our blood sugar, the balance there, our hormone milieu, how our hormones, our neuroendocrine system are functioning, our inflammatory response, our circulation and angiogenesis response, definitely our stress response or our circadian rhythm, our night and day cycles, and how we relate again or to the environment around us. So there's a lot of components here that feed into how our terrain is functioning. And so an example, just last night, we did our launch of our book. And we had a woman who came through and saw our book and asked about it. And she basically said, yeah, that's a good idea, but it's not accurate. And she was very much poo-pooing the concept of the metabolic approach and went on to say that she's lived a very healthy life, eaten a healthy diet and exercised, and yet she had cancer. And we tried to encourage her to dialogue a bit more on this, because every single patient I have ever seen over all of these 25 years have said to me, I was safe. I have no idea. And yet when we explore that tree, that terrain, and we look under the canopy, we see that there were a lot of areas where things could have gone wrong. But we don't know unless we explore it. And our culture has sort of left us limited in that exploration and left us feeling hopeless and helpless and powerless, and that, as Vogelstein's team tries to articulate, that it's just somehow simply bad luck. It's so much more than that.
Okay, that's very clear, thanks. Conventional thinking almost completely preoccupied with genes, and recent work has established the science of epigenetics. Now, I'd like you to make the distinction between the two of you would, and explain why epigenetics holds a key to staying well and to recovery from chronic disease.
Well, I think that the best kind of example, I love Dr. Bruce Lipton's work, who's the author of Biology of Belief. He talks about the concept that the right environment will prevent the mutant genes from being expressed. And that though we might be born with that blueprint, this genetic blueprint, if you will, we have the ability to change the expression. We have the ability to rearrange it, to redirect it. And that is very different than that belief system that we've spent the past, you know, 50 to 75 years under, thinking, gosh, these are my genes, and therefore I'm doomed. It's my destiny.
Right.
And luckily, the work that's come out, right, since his work in the 80s and beyond, this growing understanding of the epigenetics and how truly about 90 to 95% of our epigenetic expression is absolutely interconnected with our daily dietary lifestyle and even mental, emotional, thought, belief systems. And so we really underrate or undervalue the power that we have to change this.
Great. So that's a real a message of empowerment, isn't it, to people about their ability to influence their own situation.
It is, and I can't recall the study right now, but there was actually in the 70s and a few other repeated studies since that one of the biggest drivers of metastasis and progression and recurrence of cancer are in people who basically lost hope.
Hmm.
And so there's actual, you know, we have actual scientific research on this that, you know, losing hope or losing your empowerment around this is also a prognostic factor in how well you'll do with cancer. And so if nothing else in the past 25 years, the feedback I've gotten from the families that I've worked with is that they felt empowered. They felt like they were in the driver's seat of this process, and it changed their outcomes dramatically.
Hmm. And of course, at least anecdotally, it's if you give someone a prognosis for a period, 3 months, say, many people do die to order if they accept it.
Yes. And even Dr. Bernie Siegel's work back in the 1980s, I think he wrote Love, Medicine, and Miracles. He showed all the research around women who had joined social support, kind of cancer support groups,
mm-hmm.
that they had a longer survival rate than women who did not. You know, that really gives testament to we are powerful in knowledge and support of one another.
Mm, very much so. Okay, yeah. Now I want to go on to the big S word. Established science has long derided the idea that sugar feeds cancer. One of our leading cancer hospitals in London, on their website, they say that sugar, honey, syrup, treacle, and sugary foods such as chocolate, cakes, and sweets are good sources of energy. What do you think about this advice from a leading cancer hospital?
I have to say, I mean, I don't know what's happening over there, because we had a growing number of studies in this country between folks like Dr. Thomas Seyfried and Dr. D'Agostino and Walter Longo's work in the impact of an overfed and undernourished state on our metabolic system. We know that insulin is a growth factor for cancer. We know that. Absolute. We know what we're looking at when we look at an FDG uptake on a PET scan. It's looking for cells that are actively gobbling up the glucose that they put into the body so they could follow the imaging to see where cancer is active. I mean, my God, their own diagnostic tests show this simply by showing where glucose is most taken up, which is in the cancer cells. I am so shocked that this many years after Otto Warburg's theories, after this many years of really solid research, that this is even a conversation that we're having. It shocks me and it angers me. And part of it is, at least in the United States, less than 25% of all medical schools even offer an elective course in nutrition.
I've got to say, you may think that's bad, but it's better than the UK, where they basically don't cover it.
Oh, that's wow. And it blows my mind, because I'll have this conversation with my patients and I'll say, would you ask your auto mechanic for advice on your brain surgery? Well, why would you then ask your doctor, who had no training in nutrition, for their advice on nutrition? And so I liken those two, that it's, let them be the experts in what they know. Let them be the chemotherapists and the radio oncologists and the targeted therapy experts. Let them do that piece, but get the hell away from the dinner table when you're talking to patients undergoing the cancering process, because frankly, it is malpractice, negligence, and sheer blindness to what is extremely well established at this point. I get very fired up with this, because I run labs on all of my patients regularly, and I see absolute correlation of the lower we can get their hemoglobin A1C, their insulin, their fasting glucose, and their insulin growth factor, the better we have them responding to their conventional therapies, their adjuvant pharmaceuticals, or even their integrative therapies. And they have a better response and a better outcome and a better quality of life through the process to boot.
Right. Okay, so that's pretty clear. So the kind of nothing wrong with the sugar attitude, it's resulting in a dismissive
wow.
view towards the ketogenic diet in Britain. Dietitians, and they're described on the same leading cancer hospital website as people who give advice about diet that's based on sound scientific evidence. They're even currently mounting a forceful attack on a well-known proponent of the ketogenic diet.
Mm-hmm.
Can you briefly explain what the diet is and why it might be important to people with cancer?
So in absolute simplicity, this is about giving proper building block materials, proper fuel sources, and the most efficient and effective fuel sources to your mitochondria so they can be the most healthy that they can be. Okay. Today, our chronic illnesses, everything from Alzheimer's and autism, all the way to cancer and cardiovascular disease and everything in between, we believe are related to insufficient or ineffective mitochondrial function.
Mm-hmm.
And so given that this is our energy source for our body, yes, does the body use glucose? It sure does, but it's not as efficient as using good fats. And so, for instance, at the end of a cycle, a biochemical cycle, if you use glucose as the fuel source, you will come up a few short ATPs than you would with using fat in that same cycle. Without getting into the issues around the biochemistry, it's kind of simple there. Now, what happens with cancer cells, though, they're an aberrant metabolic process. So perhaps these nutritionists and these scientific doctors, you know, in the UK and beyond, are trying to compare the physiology of a healthy person to a cancer person, and they're different physiologies. The metabolic process of a cancer cell is very different than our healthy cells. And the metabolic process of our cancer cells becomes a sugar sink, becomes incredibly inefficient and ineffective, and starts this process. It basically, the respiration of the mitochondria basically stops, and it starts to ferment instead. So to keep it simple for people's brains, your mitochondria stops taking a deep breath. So whenever you have those stressful moments and you realize you're not breathing, remember that your mitochondria aren't breathing either in those moments, and then reset, right? Mm-hmm. And so we want them to be breathing efficiently and effectively. And if we can do that with a fuel source that is preferential, more efficient, and more protective, you're going to have better outcomes across the board. And that doesn't mean that everybody on the planet needs to be on a ketogenic diet or on a ketogenic diet forever. That we have naturally gone into ketosis since the beginning of humanity. We can go 24/7 and get food around the clock. And again, I said it earlier, but we are the most overfed and undernourished in human history. And we went from less than 5 pounds of sugar per person towards the end of the 1800s and early 1900s to, in 2018, the statistics show that each and every one of us, on average, takes in 175 pounds of sugar per person per year.
Wow.
That is an explosion. Hmm. Our bodies don't know what to do with that information. So even eating low carb is actually meaning eating normal carb in comparison to just what our recent relatives were eating, you know, our recent ancestors. And so if you look at human history on a 24-hour clock as far as our food, and so you think of a 24-hour time frame here. We've been eating higher carbohydrate, starches, grains, and legumes for about 5 seconds, okay?
Right.
And then if you look at how much we've been eating all the chemical industrialized foods that we've added to that, that's about 2 seconds old, right? So if you look at that 24-hour window, this is a whole new way of eating, and we've gotten so far away from our natural tendencies to be in kind of a feast or famine at different seasons and different regions of the world. You know, we should naturally be more scarce at certain times of the year. We should naturally be more abundant. We never get those breaks. We don't go into natural ketosis anymore. We don't go into natural autophagy. We don't go into a natural clean sweep of our GI tract. We are constantly gorging ourselves and our cells. And that's what cancer is. Cancer is an over proliferating cellular process that doesn't know when to stop.
Scary, eh? It's good to have it put in that kind of context,
yeah.
That 24-hour context. It's really, as you say, when you think of what you just put out about the amount of sugar, if you look at it on that kind of scale, how quickly that's happened, it's shocking, really.
It is, very much so. Yeah. And it's wild. I mean, even just this week in the United States, they've said we should stop giving babies fruit juice in their life and no added sugar in the first 2 years of life. That just came out in this country within this week. And I crack up. I'm like, we've been saying this to our patients for 25 years. And anyone who's been seeing an integrated practitioner or a therapeutic nutritionist or MDs who actually have a good grasp of biochemistry, because this is all biochemistry that we're talking about here, they would have said the same thing to their patients. Yet we are fed and fueled and brainwashed by a culture and by an industry that depends on our sugar addiction to thrive.
Well, 25 years seems to be about the standard period of time it takes for ideas to filter through. That's what I was saying about the absolutely sort of broken nature of the adversarial system.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
One of the big changes in the last 100 years is we have all, because of that giant infusion of sugar into our bodies, we have become more and more metabolically inflexible. And that can mean a lot of things, but one of the things that it means is that our cell walls have become much more rigid and less fluid. And one of the cool studies, or many studies actually, but one very recent study came out that cancer cells, the more rigid their cell wall, the poorer the prognosis and the more challenging it is to kill those cells. And that rigidity and that fluidity is dependent on our mitochondrial health and the fuel that we're putting them in. And basically, the more sugar you give your cells, you will take cancer cells and make them sicker, and you will take healthy cells and make them into cancer cells. And so the work of famous researcher, cancer researcher Mina Bissell, who has a fantastic TED Talk, her last name is spelled like the vacuum cleaner, Bissell. Mm-hmm. It's a 15-minute TED Talk that talks about this, she calls it as scientists, we call it the extracellular matrix. I call it the terrain. But she talks about how you can literally switch on and off the mitochondria to function into a cancering environment or a healthy environment simply by the substrate, simply by what is feeding the extracellular matrix. That is also the work of Thomas Seyfried and beyond to show, well, in cell line studies and petri dishes and in animal studies, we can certainly see that we can change the metabolic flexibility within those organisms. Well, in humans, we see that every day in the way we run tests. And then, of course, their qualitative and subjective experience as well. The patients that are eating on a lower glycemic diet will all report better quality of sleep, better quality of, lack of pain, better quality of response to their therapies with less side effects, on and on and on. Hundreds of thousands of people who've taken on this approach can't be wrong. And what we see in the labs don't lie. So it's just so weird to me that we are still even dissing this in any form or fashion, that we're not embracing it and wanting to study it and understand it even more.
Well, the movement of science is painfully slow and is usually governed, as is well known, by the need for one group of scientists or practitioners to die before major changes can be embraced.
Yeah, that's a sad but true commentary.
Okay. Another concept that's largely derided in the UK, at least, is detoxification. It's sort of seen as a kind of unimportant process that works on its own anyway. And it's a view that ties in nicely with the idea that cancer isn't much to do with our degraded environment. It's things like bad luck and genes and stuff. So how important do you think detoxing is for people with cancer and actually for everyone?
Well, when someone is actively going through a cancering process, and especially if they're undergoing pretty aggressive conventional therapies that are adding a lot of, you know, burden, if you will, to the body, I don't recommend cleansing or detoxing during that time. Mm-hmm. Already struggling very, very hard. I definitely do it in the cleanup, if you will. And of course, my preference would be that we all do it on occasion, on a regular basis, in effort of prevention. And so, you know, here it comes back again. I mean, we can even, I think when we get the word like detox or whatnot, it's become sort of mediaized, popularized, and like the Kardashians, you know, like master cleanse. It's when we talk about detoxification, I am talking about the cytochrome P450 enzyme pathways in the liver. I'm talking about the phase one and the phase two detox pathways that all doctors and all nutritionists at least should have learned in undergraduate training as well as graduate and postgraduate training, because these are the basics. This is how we metabolize our drugs. If you study or utilize pharmaceuticals, you are utilizing those detox pathways of the liver. And when we overlay that canopy I talked about earlier of epigenetics, each of us has a different fingerprint on how our own chemistry and our own SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, or our own epigenetics, interact with the environment. And so you might say, hey, this cigarette smoke isn't toxic for, you know, this person here, but these other three people have terrible experiences with it. Or, hey, this person can really tolerate a folic acid, synthetic folic acid supplement, but it makes these people terribly sick. This is where we've come in the last 10 years, is really understanding our biochemical individuality. And the brilliance of that is that we now can give absolute credence and scientific underpinnings of understanding as well as treating and supporting the detoxification pathways of our body based on the individual from what we learn. And so just because someone's like, wow, aspirin is great for anti-cancer, some people might have a great way of metabolizing it and others not. Or we might say, wow, this supplement is a really excellent treatment, you know, for cancer, but then half of the population may have particular SNPs that don't allow them to metabolize it. There are even people out there that, for instance, Taxol. Taxol is used in a lot of cancer therapies for breast cancer and ovarian cancer and whatnot. And there are about 50% of the population has what's called a pro-drug experience with this, meaning that drug is even more toxic in that person's body. And so what might be great to cure the breast cancer is likely going to take the person out with it. We don't have the excuse any longer of pretending that this doesn't exist, that there is a way to utilize our detoxification pathways better. And we also, even on the naturopathic side, we have overzealously thought that everybody could cleanse the same way as well. You know, it is nuanced. It is individualized. And working with an expert who can analyze your SNPs, your own personal blueprint, your labs, what is going on in your life, what other drugs you might be taking in the time, other supplements, herbs, and even your dietary considerations are going to need to be changed depending on your personal blueprint. And there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all. And detoxing is very individualized here. So I can understand why it's gotten a bad rap. But I also think that we've learned too much now to throw it out with the bathwater.
So along with a lot of other things, it's become a very sophisticated science, in fact.
Sophisticated on one level, but frankly quite elegant. I mean, the vitalistic ancient medicine, such as Ayurveda, Chinese medicine, naturopathic medicine, homeopathy, we have always taken in the concept of the individual, the biochemical individuality, and the patterns that that individual shows. We treat the person, not the disease. And so Western medicine is just catching up now, and they're calling this the age and era of precision medicine, of personalized medicine. I gave a talk to a group of physicians this weekend about, you know, this is the age of the ome, ending in the O-M-E, the epigenome, the nutrigenome, the inflammasome, the microbiome, on and on, right? And that is where we are finally having a conversation at the table together, scientists, researchers, clinicians, patients, right? that are saying, wow, it really is individualized. We really have to take a different approach. And that to me is exciting. I've seen more changes in the field of oncology in the last 2 years for the better than I've seen in the previous 23 years collectively.
Wow. Well,
thank you to this concept. Mm, yeah.
I'm very happy to hear that, and may it very soon come to our shores here, because I don't think it's happening here in the same way. Yeah, very exciting, very heartening.
Wow.
I know people in America think things are bad, but they haven't been over here enough. That's the problem. no, really.
That is heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
Anyway, the introduction to the book is written by Dr. Kelly Turner. She's a researcher and author of Radical Remission. She's been my guest on the show before. Her book summarizes the 9 things that all the thousands of remarkable survivors, which I think you were one of, in fact, cited as being important to their recovery. So this is the patient themselves saying what they thought was the most important thing that kept them alive despite being told they were going to die. The most noteworthy thing to me about these 9 factors is that while some of them are pretty obvious to anyone thinking of cancer in the way that you are, so radically changing your diet, using herbs and supplements, okay, they're pretty straightforward, but 7 out of the 9 fall into the territory of psychological and emotional factors. This is pretty astonishing, I think.
Yeah.
And
gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe this is reflected by the chapter in your book that's entitled Mental and Emotional Well-being: Cultivating the Most Powerful Medicine of All.
Yeah. And that's why I think Dara and I really connected, because, you know, we like found each other by doing our own work and our own research, you know, and we got to each other on different paths, but we basically came to the same conclusions. And so she has these 9 factors, and I talk about the terrain 10, but as you'll notice when I give the description of the tree, that trunk is critical, and that trunk is the mental emotional. And then Dr. Kelly talks about how, like you said, the 7 of the 9 are really on that plane, and it is so downplayed in medicine, and especially in the West. I think, you know, we're sort of like, just pull up your bootstraps and plow through, you know, or ignore it or medicate it away. And yet the most profound contributions to healing I have seen have come through this mental, emotional, spiritual doorway.
Okay, well, good. And obviously that's why you've made a big space for it in your book. I think we're going to have to leave it there. It's been really interesting to talk to you today.
Okay.
I'm sure your book's going to be a really important resource for people with cancer. Due out on the 13th of July, I believe, in the UK. And details of the book are going to be available on our Yes to Life website. So I look forward very much to it coming out here, and I think it'll probably generate a lot of interest. You thinking of coming over to the UK on your book tour?
I am. I will actually be in the UK from the 27th of June until the 10th of July.
Fantastic.
We're hoping to have some, I'll be at an international naturopathic conference where I'll be teaching, but I will also, I'm looking forward to maybe getting together with Patricia and Jane and you and Linda Ellsgood, and maybe trying to get a dialogue going about this even further. So I hope we can definitely connect again. And for your UK listeners, I'm going to be in that area, so look me up and maybe we can all get together somehow.
Lovely. Well, if you're appearing anywhere, do send us the details and we'll make sure we promote it through social media. Okay, great.
Lovely
to talk to you, Naysha. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Robin. Please keep doing your important work. So appreciated.
Thank you.
Well, I have no doubt that a lot of you will want to get your hands on a copy of Naysha's book. Take a look at the Yes to Life website, look under Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then UK Health Radio, to find a link to further information, as well as links to other resources mentioned in the show. A reminder that coming up very soon, on the 10th of June, is the Yes to Life tour of the Linseed Farm near Horsham with Derwin Banks. And on the 17th of June in London, there's a workshop on healing with painting led by the wonderful Elisabetta Fumigalli. Look under events on the Yes to Life website or on the Yes to Life Facebook page for details and for booking for these events. To keep up with developments at Yes to Life, make sure you follow us on social media. Yes to Life is well featured on Facebook and on Twitter. If you're not a social media person, then there's a news feed on the Yes to Life website. Lastly, a plug for the Yes to Life blog. It covers an enormous range of contributors and subjects and is consistently informative and a great read. There's a link to it on the top right-hand corner of every page of the Yes to Life website. Hope you can listen again next week. Wishing you the best for your health and your healthcare. Goodbye.